Welcome to Voices, the EISA podcast, the space for cutting-edge research in the discipline of international relations, and the audible companion to EISA, the European International Studies Association. This podcast sets the stage for deeper insights into award-winning papers, books, and theses, as much as it provides a room for the critical engagement with key concepts in political and sociological thought. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible. Please welcome our today's host, Polly Pallister Wilkins, political geographer and associate professor at the University of Amsterdam and board member of the EISA.
Welcome back to the EISA Voices podcast after the Northern Hemisphere summer break from myself and Judith Koch. Today we are joined by Alvina Hoffmann, the winner of this year's award for Best Article in the European Journal of International Relations. In this episode, we are going to answer the question of what makes a spokesperson and to delve deeper into issues of symbolic power, authenticity, universalism, and more. Dr. Alvina Hoffmann is a lecturer in diplomatic studies at SOAS University of London, where she researches and teaches in the areas of human rights and humanitarianism, the sociology of elites and experts, transnational professionals, socio-legal studies, and the United Nations. She is currently working on her first book, titled Speaking for the Universal, Human Rights and Elites in World Politics, that provides a historical, sociological, and collective biographical analysis of the body of independent human rights experts in the UN Human Rights Commissions, fact-finding missions, and the special procedures. Alongside EGIR, her work has appeared in International Political Sociology, the Cambridge Review of International Affairs, and Global Studies Quarterly. Welcome, Alvina. I am looking forward to discussing your article titled What Makes a Spokesperson? Delegation and Symbolic Power in Crimea. And congratulations on winning the Best Article Award. And now to my first probably easy question, and it's a soft opener, but how did this article come about?
Thank you so much. And first of all, thank you, of course, to the EISA, the prize committee, and everyone who helped me to get this article to come into the world. It was a real honor to receive this prize. And yeah, I'm looking forward to the conversation. Great question. I think this is a very important question to be able to put our work sort of in the broader perspective. And I think like any project that we do in academia, it's always kind of personal. There's always going to be a kind of personal attachment, a feeling of unease or maybe anger, other kinds of emotions, you know, maybe personal links. And I think all of these things came really together with me writing this article about Crimea. So I was born in Crimea. I have family ties in the region. Later, we moved to Germany and so on and so forth, and then in the UK to do my university studies here. But having this origin story in Crimea, having family ties in the region, the annexation happened in 2014. We all remember the kind of typical framings, you know, they still echo until this day, typical realist framings of these small territories being these kind of objects that are being thrown around by big powers. Here we have, you know, Europe and Russia, for example, vying for influence over Ukraine at that point. And so I was really upset, basically, over these depictions. They did not make sense to me of how I knew the region. They did not make sense to me based on the stories I was hearing and reading about in sort of, local newspaper articles. So I became really frustrated. This was sort of at the end of my undergraduate at that point. And I decided to write a master's thesis about this. basically just, you know, this typical post-colonial project, the many kinds of Crimeas and narratives that emerge. You know, we might remember Jutta Welde's work on Cuba, for example. So I was really, really inspired by that. So just basically bring these voices, these narratives, and kind of make sense of it in a different way, away from the kind of typical Mearsheimerian framework, or even a framework that's simply about Ukraine wanting to become part of the EU or something like that. So there was more going on, a much more kind of interesting, I would say, narrative. So that's sort of one trajectory. And then as I sort of decided to put these emotions, this feeling of unease into an academic framework, I sort of, you know, talked to my supervisor. My master supervisor was Didier Bigot at Sciences Po at that point. And I said to him, I really want to give voice to these minorities, people that are, you know, suffering from the annexation and occupation at that point, and sort of, you know, pose all almost as if I'm their spokesperson. I'm able to bring their stories to a broader audience. And the first question he was asking me was, who do you think you are to speak on behalf of Crimea? And that really set me aback. I obviously had good intentions. We all have good intentions. And, you know, I'm not at all saying that we shouldn't, you know, try to bring different struggles to different kinds of audiences. But I think that was a really important question that, you know, set in motion all of these questions I was asking about, you know, what makes a legitimate spokesperson? How can I be a spokesperson? What makes me authentic as opposed to others? All of these questions that the article basically tries to tackle. But that's sort of the two intertwined stories, the personal and then also the broader academic questions that arise from, you know, our good intentions or trying to speak on behalf of different kinds of people's struggles and so on and so forth.
So this sets up my next question perfectly. So my next question is, in the article, you, and I quote, contend that the problem of the spokesperson is central for theoretical approaches in international relations concerned with legitimacy of speech, the role of audiences, and the power of the speaker, end quote. And you say that existing theorizations up until this point have taken for granted the relationship between the speaker and the spoken for. So my questions are, why does this matter? Why, as you argue, does this leave the problem of spokespeople unexamined? And why do you identify a spokesperson problem in the first instance?
Great, excellent. Thank you so much for this great question. So I'll just start off sort of painting a very broad picture of various theories in IR that basically look at this sort of speaker and audience divide. I think there's a lot of theories that are really interested in what kind of speech resonates with what kinds of actors or audiences, or how do actors try to legitimate certain claims, or even, you know, more traditionally, what makes a particular kind of speaker powerful, charismatic, all of these theories around, for example, leadership, right? We focus on the one speaker, their words, and what makes them have, you know, a certain kind of authority and legitimacy with different kinds of groups. We can think about powerful politicians, for example, when they claim to be a natural voice for their people, leaders of social movements, government representatives at the UN General Assembly, for example. So I think we encounter this kind of relationship, you know, a lot in, you know, kind of very traditional IR, you know, locations and so on and so forth. You know, IR has obviously advanced and produced a lot of really, really great theories that, you know, look at many, many different kinds of empirical, but also theoretical settings, and basically looking at, you know, what makes speech legitimate and, you know, kind of trying to unpack this linguistic phenomenon that's happening basically between a speaker and an audience. I think also, you know, scholarship has been really, really good at not just focusing on the speaker, but also bringing to fore the audience, right? It's not just a kind of passive consumer of political speech, and it kind of resonates like an object in a sense. But this, the literature has been very good at, again, unpacking who's the audience, how does it come about, and, you know, this kind of relationship that's taking place there. But I think there's something more happening, which the literature has not addressed yet, which is basically what happens in this relationship that's sort of beyond speech, which is not just about speech moving from speaker to audience and constituting audiences, but actually when someone claims to speak on behalf of these audiences. And you know, that basically creates this different kind of group that's not just an audience listening to something or resonating or being okay with different kinds of claims, but coming into being as, you know, people that are spoken for and that are sort of okay with giving their voice to a different kind of leader. So I think this broader problem, which is the problem of the spokesperson, has been left broadly unexamined in this kind of literature. And that's sort of where my article makes the contribution and comes in from a more sociological perspective, using insights from Pierre Bourdieu's work, but kind of pushing it away from his often cynical account, I think, of the spokesperson, to basically a much more familiar IR setting, which is my, you know, interest in transnational human rights politics, to basically look at speech on behalf, not just as a rhetorical event, but something that emerges through delegation as a kind of political technology. Bourdieu refers to it as the ministry of ministry, basically, giving the spokesperson symbolic power to be able to participate in, for example, defining who's the legitimate group or people of a particular territory, who's a real Crimean, right? Is it a Russian-speaking or Ukrainian-speaking, someone with family ties? All of these questions, you know, that came about earlier that I said, that really come to the fore here, right? Who's the legitimate authoritative spokesperson over Crimea, which entails defining who's the legitimate people of Crimea in this particular point? So that's where the problem comes about. And then, you know, we can sort of start to unpack, you know, whenever a spokesperson claims to be the natural voice of a social group, right? And I'm thinking that their voice is the voice of the group and therefore brings the group into being. So there's this element of empowerment that's definitely there. And I said earlier, you know, it's fine. We need powerful spokespersons, right, who are able to articulate our struggles. So that's fine. There's this kind of element of empowerment. But then I argue, and that's sort of where the cynical Bourdieu comes in, when you delegate your voice to someone else, there's a kind of structurally inbuilt problem where when they speak instead of you, not just for you, but also instead of you. And so this paradox is kind of inbuilt in this problem of the spokesperson. So you can become silenced over time through this promise of empowerment, which is sort of built in into delegation. But that's sort of the main argument that I'm trying to sort of unpack and problematize in broader IR scholarship that relies on the separation between the speaker and the audience, bringing back this category of the spoken for and sort of presenting this paradox that cannot really be resolved, but there are, of course, creative strategies around this.
Thank you so much. So again, this question builds on what you've started to unpack in your answer to the last question. And so, as you say, your argument focuses on processes of delegation, classification struggles, and symbolic power. Can you explain for our listeners how you understand each of these? You know, how can they help us in our research?
Yeah, great. Absolutely. So you're sort of centering the three central concepts that are doing the sort of theoretical heavy lifting in the article and in developing my argument. And so I'm trying to deploy them, as I said earlier, sociologically, working with Bourdieu, but also hopefully pushing Bourdieu a little bit further in a new kind of empirical terrain, but also away from the kind of cynicism of you know, saying that any kind of relationship is a form of usurpation. So let's start off with symbolic power, which is, of course, the central concept. It's a kind of world-making power. And here specifically, but also in other contexts, it can be manifested in struggles over groups, for example, but also in imposing what Bourdieu calls doxa, kind of taken for granted assumptions about the social world, which are sort of unquestioned, which everyone buys into and doesn't even question or try to unpack further. So that's sort of, you know, this level that symbolic power operates. It brings certain groups into being, but also what we perceive as common sense. This is just common sense. This is just how it's always been. It's kind of unquestioned, an unquestioned consensus within society. And so Bourdieu, of course, said that rhetoric can also be a form of symbolic power. But in Bourdieu's account, we need to go beyond performativity. So we obviously know people like Austin or Judith Butler, very important theorists of performativity. But for Bourdieu, and kind of, you know, buying into that more sociological form of reasoning, requires to look at the authorized speaker, their broader trajectories, the broader social world, the social position they inhabit, and sort of, you know, in my work, I look at the biographical trajectories, for example, as well, look at the relations between different kinds of groups. So you really need to situate rhetoric as part of a much broader social world and go beyond just the power of words. And so what happens then, specifically coming back to my example of Crimea, is to look again, how does symbolic power make visible, you know, who are the dominant actors and how they define how we perceive Crimea? What are the categories that are allowed to be used to even talk about Crimea, right? Russian-speaking, Ukrainian-speaking, real Crimeans are X, Y, Z, right? In this account already, for example, Crimean Tatars, other kinds of minorities, cannot really be easily mapped onto these kind of dominant categories with which Crimea has been painted, whether from the Russian side or in sort of traditional Anglo-American IR scholarship as well. In other contexts, in IR scholarship, this question has been used, for example, to analyze what makes a genuine diplomat, right? Rebecca Adler-Nissen's work has been quite useful and helpful in that regard, to look at the emergence of a new kind of European or EU diplomatic service, which kind of challenges traditional diplomacy that's sort of, you know, based on representing a state, right? And so again, there's a fight over a category, over a social group, like a diplomat, right? Who's an insider, who's an outsider? And so that sort of applies as well in my case of Crimea. So it's really about imposing how we perceive the world, the kind of cognitive schemes, what makes a group as a group or come out or stand out as a group. And that then creates this paradox I talked earlier about, you know, where a group, you know, becomes empowered through the spokesperson, but can also be silenced at the same time. So that's sort of where symbolic power can become a form of symbolic violence as well. And of course, that links, you know, I was sort of referring to classification struggles in my answer to the question already, which is very deeply connected to that, right? So different kinds of groups can impose different kinds of social classificatory categories, right? A different kind of social space can be structured and analyzed according to different kinds of, you know, principles of vision and division, as Bourdieu says. Different kinds of classifications can clash. But I think for us academics, what's also quite important is to know, once, you know, we go into a space, you might be doing ethnographic work or interviews, this is a space that's also already classified by the actors themselves. They deploy different kinds of categories about themselves, right? Powerful organizations will have discourses about themselves, will have certain concepts they use to describe their leadership style, right? And so it also sort of forces you as an academic to kind of pause and map that and not to reproduce different kinds of actors' own kind of classificatory categories or, you know, their own kind of accounts of themselves as being powerful, right? Call the shots, you know. So that's sort of the two-way relationship, right? We find the space, but also as academics to be able to again, sociologize a little bit this world of classification struggles. And then finally, delegation is, of course, another very, very central concept as a kind of political technology or a kind of social process, which I imagine is a kind of spiral, right? It moves speech from a group to a spokesperson over time, right? So the group is, you know, sort of stands behind a powerful spokesperson, really recognizes them as someone that might be able to represent their struggle. But, you know, over time, as more and more speech and moves to the spokesperson, the kind of paradox starts to kick in, right? You're sort of empowered, you came into being as a group, but you're also silenced because you are no longer able to articulate your own struggles in this kind of way. And so Bourdieu would say that the power of words is nothing other than the delegated power of the spokesperson. So delegation is really sort of the key social process that brings the spokesperson into being.
Fantastic. And so following on from this, how do issues of authenticity and universality work in the context of local spokespersons and human rights spokespersons in Crimea? And you differentiate importantly between local spokespeople and human rights spokespeople.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Yeah, that's a very important question and sort of gets to, you know, what is sort of at stake beyond the very, very big stakes of course, where should Crimea belong in these fights, right? But what are sort of the symbolic stakes that, I guess, structure different kinds of arguments, different kinds of claims between different kinds of spokespersons? And so that is sort of the central stake in my article, which is to say there's a certain struggle over who's the authentic representative. And you have sort of Russian-speaking, even Russian politicians emerging after the annexation, posing as real Crimeans. You have Crimean Tatar leaders emerging. You have other kinds of, you know, people emerging and kind of claiming that they sort of are able to capture the heart and what's sort of at stake at Crimea. That's sort of one fight that plays out over who's sort of locally positioned and has sort of local knowledge to be able to claim to be an authentic representative. And then the other kind of fight or struggle that plays out is in sort of in the specific realm of human rights politics that I'm, you know, more broadly interested in. But again, you know, human rights articulations can be quite different from, again, local activists, human rights lawyers who are in Crimea, who are part of the struggles, versus missions that are
doing their kind of work at a distance because they're unable to enter Crimea versus missions that kind of, you know, extraordinarily managed to actually get access to Crimea in 2016, like the Council of Europe mission, but, you know, were only able to spend a few days there, right? And so you have, again, very different ways to articulate human rights based on what your understanding of the universal is, of what makes an expert on universal human rights, and of course, based on who's actually part of the struggle and able to witness different kinds of violations. So that's sort of how I set up the article. But of course, in real life, these two struggles will always be intertwined, and something we might get to later as well. And so when we talk about the struggle over authenticity, right, what makes an authentic spokesperson? So we're really trying to answer, you know, who's basically able to authentically capture what is going on in Crimea. Some of these questions that arose are about certain kinds of leaders of different kinds of social movements. Are they seen as being close to people? Can leaders that were sent into exile still articulate different kinds of struggles? So not from afar. Some leaders of the Crimean Tatar groups, for example, were banned from the territory and then sent to Kiev. And so again, you find yourself in this paradox, right? You're no longer with your people, but at the same time, you're actually now quite close to the center of power in Ukraine at the same time. And you're able to bring certain claims, for example, to the European Court of Human Rights, to the International Court of Justice, and so on and so forth. So there's some interesting question again, where this paradox kind of plays out, you know, where people think it is important to be present locally, but at the same time, it is important to also have leaders that are close to power. So this, again, something that cannot really be resolved, but questions that arise around, again, who's able to authentically capture who the people are? Who are our leaders, right? Are they politicians? Are they activists? Are they mothers of, for example, Crimean Tatar fathers who have been, you know, imprisoned for 10, 15, 20 years because the kind of new Russian administration considers them terrorist activists because they were part of a particular kind of group that was not banned in Ukraine, but banned in Russia, or sometimes completely made up charges as well. So you have a context in which these mothers, you know, used to be in the home, in a kind of very traditional patriarchal home, husbands become imprisoned, and they're starting to take on these very important leadership roles in a society. And they start to become people that a lot of people turn to as well when something happens, right? So it's a very interesting kind of context that I'm talking about. Sort of, you know, this was 2018, 2019, before the full-scale invasion, of course, where most of my empirical data is based on. But you see these shifts happening, right? Who is able to articulate authentically what is going on in Crimea from these very popular kind of, you know, man politicians to women who started taking on these more prominent roles as well. And the same kind of applies as well to, for example, UN human rights experts. You want your organizations, right? You want to have the attention of the world. You want the UN to pay attention, right? And so you kind of collaborate with them. But at the same time, when the report is issued by someone who was not in the territory, again, you find yourself in this paradox. What do we do with this? We have been with our people for, you know, 2, 3, 4 years. Others come in or even do this at a distance. So this paradox, again, comes to the fore as well. And so that then opens up the broader question about the universal as well. It's not just about who captures what's going on, but also what is the universal around human rights as well, right? What kind of expertise is valued in articulating human rights as a kind of, you know, universal that comes to the fore here? Is it those who are able to stay locally with the people? Is it those who have been doing this kind of job, you know, at the UN and other organizations for a very, very long time and have sort of this claim to understand what human rights law is, regardless of the kinds of context? So these are sort of the kind of tensions and fault lines that emerge between different kinds of groups. Again, you know, who's able to articulate the universal because their expertise is maybe valued more than other kinds of expertise.
Okay, so you've started to introduce us to some of your empirics that underpin this article and your wider work. So perhaps we can take a slight detour here and talk about the methods that you used for this article, or what you call your research strategy to capture symbolic power relations. So how did you gather the data used for your analysis?
Yes, that's another very, very good question. Given sort of the very particular international legal status that Crimea has been enjoying since the annexation, I was unfortunately unable to travel there. So you have to develop different means to kind of, you know, be able to talk to people, identify the right kind of people. So I focused, which is, I think, important to say at the beginning, I focused specifically on investigative journalists, on activists, either Ukrainian kind of investigative journalists or local activists, part of sort of the Crimean Tatar group. And I did not focus on Russian politicians that took over Crimea. So that's sort of very important distinction to make here, which could be a very important project as well. But I focused mostly on struggles around human rights and those actors that would use the language of human rights to articulate an alternative vision of Crimea. So I basically began with, you know, as we all do, what are the reports written by different organizations, international, but also local from a Ukrainian side, different kinds of, you know, very rare, of course, but different kinds of newspaper accounts written by investigative journalists who managed to get access, managed to get a special license to access Crimea. And usually they were written, I noticed this immediately, by very, very brave women investigative journalists from Ukraine. And I saw this on outlets like Open Democracy, Radio Free Europe, which these days, some of them have been shut down. Others suffer, of course, from funding cuts, which is very, very sad. But these are really important outlets because they translate their work, which is written, you know, either in Ukrainian or in Russian, for an English audience. And, you know, again, someone who's able to bring that to a different kind of audience. And then I just wrote to these outlets, told them about my project, and they were very kind to connect me with these journalists. So that was really, really amazing. And I speak Russian, so there was no issue speaking Russian to me. So we had a really great conversation with some of these investigative journalists about how they managed to get access. And as I mentioned earlier, I noticed that many of them, most of them were women. And they told me the story about how basically because they were women, no one took them seriously and they just allowed them to go and see these court cases. You know, we all sometimes tend to use that, you know, in ethnography as well. You know, you ask a certain question and you being explained or mansplained certain things, which helps a lot. But that was sort of the interesting setup that allowed them to actually witness a lot of court cases, be part of struggles, and sort of then connect me to, again, a lot of women locally of kind of Crimean Tatar groups for children of imprisoned fathers and other kinds of citizen journalists. And so they then, you know, connected me to different kinds of human rights lawyers, activists, and I was able to speak to them as well. Extremely generous with their time, really, really wonderful people, absolutely amazing stories that they were telling me. And of course, very, very happy to share their stories again. And again, I'm noticing it's basically women doing that kind of work, this really interesting societal shift that was happening, something I didn't explore in the article, but something that was very, very obvious as well. So speaking to them as well, but then also, you know, connecting it to other organizations, you know, reaching out to the Ukrainian UN office, for example, again, very generous local people who told me about how they're sort of going about writing their reports without being able to access the territory. Council of Europe mission that I mentioned earlier that was able, as the only international kind of organization, to get there in 2016. The main diplomat leading the mission retired, so retired diplomats are always very happy to speak to you. We had a very interesting conversation in Geneva as well, which I was also very, very grateful for. So you slowly kind of start to, you know, develop or assemble your different kinds of narratives by different kinds of actors, what's going on, and you see the kind of fault lines emerging as well. And so initially, my interviews were sort of focusing on, you know, typical question, you know, what are your kind of legal strategies? You know, what do you do in a day to day? What does human rights mean to you? And so on and so forth. But as you sort of, you know, advance in your interview, both individually, but also, you know, with other kinds of people, the interviews kind of started to shift around who's basically a reliable or trusted spokesperson on the situation of Crimea. So this is something that they grapple with themselves as well, right? Who's, you know, we talked about this earlier, who's a new leader in a sense? And what do we do with leaders that are now in exile, right? Issues of proximity to marginalized groups versus someone who has legal expertise versus someone who has contacts to different kinds of forums, all of these kind of struggles that came to the fore, right? Which was really, really important. And so for me, that slowly then this data allowed me to kind of reframe them or analyze them as different kinds of examples of symbolic power struggles. And so just to add a few sort of more methodological approaches, I used Bourdieu's Weight of the World, which is one of his last books published before he died. And he has a really amazing kind of appendix towards the end about interviews and other kinds of data, and his kind of really, you know, refreshing reflections about interviews, different from, you know, you have your semi-structured interviews and you ask them, you know, we all know the drill. But really thinking about what Bourdieu says, how the interview actually creates conditions for an extraordinary discourse, right? So this is something that allows both not just you to gain knowledge, but actually also for the interview themselves to reflect on certain things and to kind of be each other, us analyzing what is going on together, right? It's a much more kind of collaborative thing rather than me having a set of questions. But this kind of conversation that really is quite extraordinary, right? It's not something that you're being asked to do daily unless you're, you know, a very famous spokesperson and you're constantly interviewing. So that was really something that resonated with me a lot doing interviews, right? And then how do you prepare yourself for an interview? You, of course, have to have knowledge of the case and you show your knowledge and you read your reports. But I think also showing a certain, you know, amount of empathy and empathizing with their struggles. I mean, it's very important as well, right? To just acknowledge what they're going through and how horrible it is and to have this kind of connection. And that's where my own personal connection, I mentioned this at the very beginning of this, were also quite interesting, right? Your own story. I was born there, my own family from the Soviet Union, all around, kind of, you know, different stories of moving and migration, I think also resonated with them again, right? So again, the kind of discourse or kind of extraordinary discourse I was able to have with them might have been maybe different if my story had been different. Speaking in Russian to them, which is also one of their native languages, also allowed me again to connect with them in different ways. So yeah, that was sort of my strategy, right, is to kind of put these different interview scripts in conversation with each other and seeing, you know, what are certain fault lines and struggles emerging in these kinds of conversations and in their own way of making sense of what's going on.
I want us to broaden out a bit now to think about the role of the universal in the international. Now, the idea of the universal obviously plays a central role, not just in this article, but in your work more broadly. Why is that? What is it about the universal or universalism in international relations that interests you?
Absolutely. Thank you for this great question, which is something I've been thinking about or grappling with together with my friend Emma McCluskey and my friend and former PhD supervisor Didier Bigot as well, through the work of a philosopher called Suleiman Bashir Diagne, which I mentioned in a second. But as you say, you know, our article, our work is always part of a broader trajectory, and it leads you to sort of the next kinds of questions. And so beginning with these local human rights struggles connected me to a different kind of actor. I mentioned the UN earlier. I mentioned the Council of Europe, but there's also the UN Special Rapporteur as a kind of interesting actor that's not a UN bureaucrat, independent human rights expert, sometimes able to say things that are being depicted as this is a UN expert. And how is the UN able to say actually such progressive things on certain issues? So that led me to kind of examining more broadly, you know, the figure of the UN Special Rapporteur, which I'm currently researching and writing a book on. And so for me, the universal is still connected to human rights, but kind of on a more transnational level by following these trajectories of the UN Special Rapporteur. And I just mentioned this Senegalese, French / American philosopher Suleiman Bashir Diagne, who just retired from Columbia University. And I thank Didier Bigot and Emma McCluskey to introducing me to him. And he has this really, really interesting concept of the lateral universal. So opposed to kind of vertical top-down imposed universal from one viewpoint, this is a universal that's kind of emerging in struggles, in encounters, in reciprocity. And what I find quite exciting or interesting is that this is not about rejecting the idea of the universal as such, right? So we can critique, and he's quoting a kind of French Algerian philosopher here in his book, we can critique particular kinds of conceptions of the universal, whether that's a kind of colonial universal, right? The kind of mission civilisatrice, for example, right? Other kinds of, you know, emergent universals, like cosmopolitan universals. Then we have the universal of 48, of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which again is sort of, you know, it's extremely important, but it's sort of again, this one viewpoint of the UN that's sort of then imposed, and then states, you know, can decide whether or not they will actually adhere to these principles, to now thinking about a much more horizontal universal, right? Thinking about, you know, how do we connect with each other in kind of building this universal in a much more lateral way, right? Through travel, through learning, through translation. He has this book coming out as well, has just actually come out, which was translated from French into English. So it's a kind of universal of translation from him, which I think is quite exciting. And then in his work, he actually mentions the UN as well, the General Assembly, where each state has one voice and the kind of seen as equals, right? And this is for him what the universality of human rights means in practice, right? They negotiate, they have these encounters, they force to kind of talk to each other to translate different things. And so it's quite interesting to me how for this philosopher, the UN is still, you know, this kind of central focal point in which these questions can come to bear, because some of our IR theorists might be quite cynical about it. But I think right now we actually see a very interesting moment emerging, and I'll get to that probably in a bit as well, of, you know, who articulates the universal away from Western powers, the P5 of the Security Councils, to the global south. And something that comes to mind to me is, I think it was earlier this week, Netanyahu was giving a speech at the UN, who's obviously sought by the ICC as a war criminal. An arrest warrant has come out last year. And many, I don't know, I didn't see numbers, but we see many, many representatives of states walking out, booing and walking out, right? And I think that's a very, very powerful way of articulating this equality, right? We're not accepting that international law does not apply, you know, to you, that applies to everyone. And so I think that's a very interesting moment when we see, you know, this shift happening, where we don't reject the universal, but actually a new kind of universal emerges that's based on solidarity and a kind of common aim of emancipation, but also, you know, who enacts these principles. We're not just, you know, throwing everything out. These are extremely important principles, and we need to enact them, right? Using, you know, the International Court of Justice, the ICC, the General Assembly, which are forums that enjoy this kind of authority, not just within states, but also I think more and more so as a kind of popular authority. And just a shout out again to my friend Emma McCluskey, who's also researching these more everyday kind of enactments of international law by different kinds of people, rather than, you know, just focusing on politicians who are not following international law. So I think, you know, shifting our analysis away from high politics to these kinds of articulations of the universal by actors that, you know, we're not used to kind of centering is quite important, and hopefully gives us interesting tools to think about it in a different way, away from a kind of vertical top-down universal that's quite imperialist.
Thank you so much. Perhaps we can also see the global Samud flotilla that's happening right now as a kind of example of this kind of lateral universalism, right? That's, you know, because they very much draw
absolutely on
the language of human rights, but in a way that is meant as an emancipatory, or at least as an act of solidarity, right? And challenging those very sort of, I have a lot to say about this, and I won't go into it now, because I want to ask you questions. And so my final question is, do you see the issues of authenticity and universalism that you identified in the article present in context beyond spokespersons in Crimea? And I think you started to touch on this. So do you see it in other international contexts, or contexts that are of interest to us other international relations researchers?
Absolutely. And I didn't mention Francesca Albanese in the previous answer, but I think that to me is another kind of really interesting spokesperson, right? For some, she's, you know, a new hero. Others depict her for some reason as being highly controversial, but you never know why really. So that's a very interesting person that emerges. She's, of course, one of those special rapporteurs that I'm really interested in. And she's really someone who managed to use this title of special rapporteur to really transcend, let's say, very technical discussions around human rights, you know, focus maybe much more in academic settings, but to really, really be able to communicate this knowledge out to the broader public. So I think That was extremely impressive. And just what she's been able to do to bring this figure of the special rapporteur on our radar globally is extremely important. And I think Francesca Albanese has been seen also as a kind of symbol, as a figure that's been able to articulate a new kind of interconnected universalism. And this is actually how she frames it herself, right? So we saw the General Assembly, different kinds of leaders walking out, the ICC, the ICJ, and she's really someone that believes in these tools, right? It's just we haven't unlocked their potential fully, especially these tools around human rights law. So I think attending her public talks in universities, she's extremely articulate, knows obviously the situation in Gaza and Palestine more broadly really, really well, but also someone who really believes in the tools of human rights law, and kind of very interestingly, or is very good at analyzing international law and the colonial origins as a kind of separate history from the emergence of human rights law. Sometimes we tend to think about them as sort of, you know, being the same almost, right? So I think that kind of belief in the tools is, you know, can be quite inspiring for the kinds of actors you mentioned earlier as well, right? And so if we think about, you know, who are the leaders on the left these days, internationally or transnationally, that are able to kind of represent struggles authentically without sort of ceding ground to whatever the right is sort of asking them to do, anti-migration and so on and so forth. How do these leaders present themselves? What makes them sort of authentic and kind of grounded in different kinds of struggles, right? I talked about the universal, her belief in these kinds of tools, but also how she's able to create these links between different kinds of struggles and movements around the world, from Latin America to Africa, is really quite interesting. And I think links really, really well to the lateral universal, right? And she basically proclaims that there's this new international order emerging. It's not subordinated to the West. It's grounded in dignity, solidarity, and justice. And we have these alternative visions. And she, you know, connects African Ubuntu to Colombian magical realism, to indigenous cosmologies. So I find this really, really exciting, right? It's not just thinking about them as completely separate phenomenons, but actually, what are their links that kind of make or remake a different kind of international order, right? How do we create these links between, you know, these articulations? But of course, we have to be not super naive, but also unpack again, how are these leaders able to articulate these different visions and these different kinds of struggles in a way that resonates with people again, right? And again, what I find so interesting about Francesca Albanese is, she gets a lot of hatred, vitriol. The US had just imposed sanctions on her in July, which is a completely unprecedented step against UN special rapporteurs. I mean, they face sort of, you know, sometimes states try to bring them to court, but this is a really unprecedented step. And most, if not all, special rapporteurs have spoken out against this, which is very, very important. Once you start attacking one, slowly, slowly, you will start attacking the integrity of the whole system. And then you ask these questions, you know, you ask her, how are you doing? You know, what does this do to you? And she's always, always framing this as a distraction. Let's focus on the genocide that's happening in Gaza, that many organizations, many scholars, experts have called out for what it is. The rest is just a distraction, right? She says she's become a symbol not by choice, but basically because she symbolizes what it means to speak out, right? To position yourself as a spokesperson for a struggle, and then you get punished, right? That's sort of the symbol she's become. And so I think when she says we must act collectively, depersonalize the struggle, and become more warriors, I think that's sort of a really sort of nice translation of this more philosophical discussion we had earlier about the kind of lateral universal into more advocacy activist type languages, and to really tap into these alternative visions around the world that are emerging, right? And for me, you know, I was really interested in Crimean Tatars locally, their alternative visions of history, how they connect collectively, how they become activists, and us being able to reconnect to our own local struggles, but not just as bounded ones as many politicians wanted to be, but really see the connections with others. There's a really nice quote that Suleiman Bashir Diagne actually put in one of his books, citing Senghor, the kind of former president of Senegal, and one of the kind of thinkers of the Negritude movement, which is basically something about how the universal emerges in this kind of encounter or tension between the pride of being different measured against the happiness of being together. And I really, really like this. And, my work, you know, as I'm working through these questions of the universal, I want to think more along these lines, right? This difference and universal and how they can relate to each other in this non-colonial way.
I think that's a fantastic place to end this podcast. I think that's a question that all of us should be considering more deeply. And so thank you. Thank you, Alvina, for such a fantastic conversation. And for everyone who hasn't read the article yet, they should go and read the article and also read your rider work. And we look forward to the book.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you for listening. Please find all information on today's interview guests and host in the show notes. Voices, the EISA podcast, is available on all established podcast platforms. If you liked it, subscribe now. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible.